Thank you for listening to Northern Star, a Grain Elevator murder mystery. This Grain Journal podcast is sponsored by PerkinElmer and M&M Specialty Services. PerkinElmer, with more than 50 years of experience with grain and oilseed trading companies, we know and understand your business. Our comprehensive range of products and solutions for grain and oilseed analysis, composition, function, and safety will help you in your daily work and improve your bottom line. PerkinElmer, innovating for a healthier world. M&M Specialty Services, LLC specializes in protecting people and commodities with the best in products, services, and training, from personal protective equipment to grain protectants, IGRs, fumigants, and fumigation services, as well as complete IPM programs. You get out what you put in with M&M.
Northern Star, Part 39. Gil Mayer is now acting general manager at Northern Star Farmers Cooperative, and his first act on the job is to confront employee Calvin Fogerson, accusing him of the murder of high school football star Marcus Grover and Superintendent Solly Finkel. "This is completely insane," Calvin said. "What about Ole? What about Eddie Lofgren? They've been ripping off the co-op. They had every reason to murder Solly. He knew too much." "And I'm sure you knew about it too," Gil replied. "Not that you were in on it. Ole and Eddie wouldn't have trusted you that far. But I'm sure 2 nights ago wasn't the first time you'd broken into the safe. My guess is that you didn't say anything about it to anyone because you knew that if the police ever found out about their little scheme, they might have reason to suspect them of murder too. After all, it was well known that Eddie Lofgren had it in for Marcus Grover." "That's right," Calvin said. "He's the one who did it. He hated Marcus for getting involved with his daughter." "That's true, but it doesn't add up. To begin with, Eddie Lofgren had a pretty good chance to kill me too, or at least his son Bob did. And I did get knocked upside the head and left in a ditch in Mankato. The thing is, though, Eddie or Bob didn't kill me. I'm still around. So my guess is that they didn't kill me when they had the chance. They probably didn't kill Solly, either, or Marcus." "Anyway," Gil continued, "I know Eddie Lofgren didn't kill Marcus Grover, because he wasn't at the elevator that night. He was with his stepdaughter. She told me." "That's impossible," Calvin said. "No one knows where she is. She disappeared after Marcus Grover died. She's probably dead." "No. Michelle is very much alive," Gil said. "I found her. She's in Florida." "Well, no, actually, she's on her way to Iowa right now to tell the police what happened to her the night Marcus Grover died. Eddie Lofgren's in a lot of trouble right now, but he isn't going to face a murder rap. You are." Gil reached for the phone. Suddenly, Calvin grabbed a paperweight off of Ole's desk and flung it at Gil. Gil ducked behind the desk and heard a loud thud as the paperweight crashed against the plywood covering of the back wall. Calvin moved toward the locked door to the office, but Gil was already circling around the desk to cut him off. Calvin picked up the chair he'd been sitting in and flung it through the window. The glass shattered with a loud crash. Before Gil could stop him, Calvin was through the window as well. Gil ran up to the window and saw Calvin roll onto the parking lot blacktop. Calvin picked himself up and began running toward the elevator. Gil could see that the young man was bleeding from a gash in his forehead, and one shirt sleeve was torn and bloody, too. Gil unlocked the office door and stopped long enough to shout at Connie, "Get the police here right away. Tell them I have the murderer, and he's fleeing the scene." Gil didn't wait for a reaction. He bounded out the front of the building and circled around toward the elevator. Down at the far end of the structure, he saw Johnny Littlefeather working on a partially disassembled aeration fan. "Johnny," Gil shouted, "we've got to stop Calvin. He's headed for the elevator." Johnny looked up from his work and stood there, probably confused. Gil made a large gesture toward the elevator where Calvin was disappearing into the doorway leading to the man lift. Gil's heart sank. He knew that by the time he or Johnny could get there, Calvin could be out the door of the rail side and could disappear into the residential neighborhood on the other side of the tracks. At least, Gil thought to himself, that's what he would do in that situation. Johnny was running across the parking lot, and Gil caught up with him about halfway between the office building and the elevator. "Calvin's the murderer," Gil said. "We've got to stop him before he gets away." He went through the elevator door. Gil was grateful to have Johnny Littlefeather there. He knew Johnny had a cool head in a crisis, and he was the only person at the Monrovia elevator with a military combat experience, as far as Gil knew. "I'll circle around to the other side," Gil said. "Maybe I can stop him before he gets to the tracks." Gil heard a sharp crack behind him, and out the corner of his eye he saw a puff of dust rise up from the blacktop about 10 feet to their right. Instantly, it registered with him that he heard the report of a hunting rifle. He turned in time to catch a glimpse of someone moving away from the guardrail around the roof of the elevator. "He's on the roof and he's armed," Gil said. He wondered how long Calvin must have had a rifle and ammunition hidden away on the roof of the elevator in the event that he was ever found out. It could have been a long time. There was a lot of places you could hide something like that and have it go undetected for months. It's possible Calvin could have obtained the weapon or stolen it from his father, who was active in right-wing militias. There was another crack and another puff of dust, this time closer to the two men. They sprinted to the elevator and flattened themselves against the wall. Gil knew it would be a difficult shot for Calvin to hit them there, if he could do it at all. He heard the sound of sirens and saw three police cruisers pull up to the office building. Half a dozen officers got out. Gil recognized one of the cops as Detective Lieutenant Kellerman, even from that distance. Gil gestured at them frantically, then pointed at the roof. He wasn't sure if he was getting the message across, but then he heard another rifle shot. The cops ducked and scrambled behind their cruisers. Gil knew one of them would be calling for a backup. He turned to Johnny. "I think we could have this over with before the cops can act," he said. "Otherwise, one or more of them might get hurt." Johnny nodded. The two men began inching along the wall toward the door. It took a couple of minutes. More cars were arriving. Gil wasn't sure how the police could get Calvin down from the roof. They couldn't safely get across the open area between the office building and the elevator. He knew the state police probably had a helicopter available at their post near Mason City, but Calvin could just as easily shoot at a helicopter as the police on the ground, and a helicopter going down in a residential neighborhood would kill innocent people. The Monrovia police could bring in a SWAT team, and a police sharpshooter might be able to hit Calvin from some distance away. But there was a lot of metal equipment to hide behind, and as much as he wanted to see justice done, Gil wasn't sure he wanted Calvin dead. He'd rather see a proper trial and Calvin locked up for the rest of his life. Johnny reached the door to the elevator and slipped inside. Gil followed him. Johnny quickly moved over to the van lift and punched at the call button. "It's locked out," he said. "I'm not surprised." The van lift was equipped with a governor that prevented it from starting up if the door was open, a safety feature mandated by state law. At some elevators, workers disconnected the governor, but Gil knew that Ole was a stickler for workplace safety and would never have stood for that. "There's the ladder," Johnny said. "Calvin could shoot at us from up there," Gil commented. "Not unless he moves the man lift cage out of the way." "And even then he wouldn't have a clear shot until we got close to the top," Johnny told Gil. "In other words, point-blank range," Gil said. "I have an idea, though. Let me have your radio." Johnny pulled his two-way radio from his belt. Gil took it and called up the office. "Car here," Gil heard the voice of the elevator merchandiser. "What's going on out there?" Gil asked. "The cops are busy setting up a perimeter," Howie replied. "We've already got town people arriving. You know small towns." "Yeah," Gil said. "Look, is there a fire truck here yet?" "I think it's on the way." "Howie, I want you to do something for me," Gil said. "We need a diversion here. See if you can get the cops to send the fire truck down to the east end of the elevator, like they're going to try to set up a ladder to get up onto the roof down there." "I'll try," Howie said. "I don't think they would do that. Calvin could shoot at them from the roof." "They don't need to actually send anyone up the ladder," Gil said. "They just need to distract Calvin's attention." "Okay, I'll give it a try. Car out." "Let's hope this works," Gil told Johnny. "Come with me." The two men went into the electrical room. "Can you do a lockout on the man lift?" Gil asked. "Sure," Johnny said. "But the man lift is blocking the entrance into the headhouse." "How do we get through?" "Usually they have an access door through the top in the event someone gets trapped in there," Gil said. "Yeah, but it would take a while to unscrew the access panel, and it won't take Calvin long to figure out what's going on, Johnny said. I have a better idea. The ladder continues on up to an access door onto the roof of the headhouse. That'll get us up there a lot faster. Okay, let's try that, Gil agreed. Johnny took his lockout device from his tool belt, opened the electrical panel for the man lift, snapped off the power, and then locked it out. Then the two men headed back to the ladder. Johnny grabbed the side of the ladder, then pulled it suddenly, shouting in obscenity. It's electrified, he said. The little creep has it wired, probably with one of those electric fence generators they use on cattle farms. Northern Star, Part 40. In an attempt to flee a murder rap, Calvin Fogerson is holed up on the roof of the Northern Star Farmers Cooperative Grain Elevator in Monrovia. He's armed with a rifle, locked out of the van lift, and used an electric fence generator to electrify the ladder leading up to the roof. Acting General Manager Gil Mayer and Superintendent Johnny Littlefeather are trying to figure out how to get to the roof before the Monrovia Police Department call in the National Guard helicopter with a sniper. Gil and Johnny stood in front of the man lift cage, debating their next move. Gil put his hand on the walkie-talkie. Maybe Howie can call the power company and have them shut off the power, he said. It probably wouldn't do any good, Johnny replied. Usually the electric fencing units run on battery power. They have to keep cattle penned in some pretty remote areas, and often as not, power line isn't available nearby. My uncle ranches up in South Dakota, and he has a unit that can broadcast some 100 miles. Gil thought for a moment. What about the man lift cable? Maybe we could get to the top of the cage and climb up the cable. Was all Johnny said in reply. He gingerly touched the man lift door. Nothing happened. Okay, he doesn't have the cable electrified, or I wouldn't be able to touch the steel cage. Okay, Gil said, let's undo the hatch in the roof and I'll shinny up the cable. What do you mean you, old man? Johnny said, I'm in better shape than you are. And what do you mean by old man? Gil replied, I'm less than 5 years older than you are. I repeat, I'm in better shape than you are, Johnny said. I'm down at the gym doing an hour of circuit training every day, and after that I do an hour on the weights. Unless you can match that, I can't believe you're in better shape. Besides, it's 110 feet to the top, and if you touch that ladder at any point on the way up, you'll lose your grip and fall. You know, the first day you came here, you accused me of being a circus performer? Well, here's a chance to put that to good use. Gil's walkie-talkie squawked, and Howie Carr's voice said, Hey, Gil. Yeah, Gil said. Look, the police are starting to get impatient, Howie told Gil. The chief is saying that his people are in danger, not to mention the general public, as long as Calvin is up there with a rifle. I understand. See if you can hold them off, even for 15 minutes. I'll try, Howie said. It might not be my decision to make. You heard that, Gil told Johnny. We don't have a lot of time, so I guess I'll go along with your plan. What will you do when you get to the top? He'll have some sort of wire hooked onto the ladder. Somewhere up there, Johnny said. I'll just reach over with a wire cutter and cut it, and then you can climb up the ladder. You understand what you just told me about touching that ladder, Gil said. I've already got Sally Finkel's death on my conscience. I don't want yours, too. Trust me, I'll be okay, Johnny replied. Gil opened the gate to the man lift, and he and Johnny stepped inside. Ole Torvaldsen, or one of his predecessors, had sprung for a top-of-the-line man lift whenever it had been installed, so there was plenty of room for the two men. Johnny handed Gil a spare screwdriver, and the two men began unscrewing the roof hatch. When they were through, Johnny gave the hatch a shove, and it opened with a loud metallic crash. You think Hal Calvin heard that? Johnny asked. Hard to say, Gil commented. From most places upstairs, probably not, unless he's inside the headhouse. There's a lot going on to keep him distracted. I'm counting on that, Johnny said. Give me a boost. Gil bent over, and Johnny stepped on Gil's outstretched hands. Gil shoved and stood up, and the strong superintendent pulled himself up quickly onto the top of the man lift cage. Okay, he said. Here it goes. Gil watched Johnny through the top of the cage as the superintendent began pulling himself up the cable. Gil marveled at how quickly Johnny could move. Still, 3 or 4 minutes it took Johnny to reach the top after disappearing into the shadows seemed to last an hour. Finally, the cable rattled. Gil figured that was a signal that Johnny had reached the top and didn't want to shout anything down for fear of being heard. Another minute passed, and Gil heard the clank as sounded as if the ladder was being struck. The clanking continued on for regular intervals. Gil interpreted that to mean that Johnny had cut the electricity to the ladder. The manager stepped around behind the man-lift cage and reached out to the ladder, hesitating momentarily. He grabbed a rung and felt nothing but cold steel under his grip. Gil breathed a sigh of relief and began climbing up, trying to make as little noise as possible. Above him, Gil could see Johnny, also clinging onto the ladder. The manager was a little annoyed by the amount of dust covering his hands, but then he reminded himself that Johnny had a much tougher climb. Johnny had stopped just below the opening for the headhouse. As Gil approached, he looked down. "I think he's outside the headhouse, out on the roof somewhere," he said in a soft voice with just enough volume to carry down to Gil. "There's a lot of machinery outside for him to hide in." "Okay," Gil replied. "If you think it's safe, why don't you go out onto the headhouse and see if there is a way to sneak out and surprise him. I'll continue up through the hatch onto the top of the headhouse." "He could see you and shoot at you," Johnny said. "Maybe," Gil said. "Some 5 years ago, during an upgrade, the top of one of the receiving legs had been extended up through the top of the headhouse. From there, a large distributor and a scalper cleaner were mounted on top of the headhouse. Depending on the angle," Gil thought, "Calvin may or may not be able to spot someone climbing out through the hatch. If we both go through the headhouse, he can shoot at us both at the same time," Gil explained. "If he does see me, maybe I can distract him long enough for you to get out through the door and go after him." "Sounds like a plan," Johnny said. The two men heard a sharp crack, somewhat muffled by concrete walls. Gil's walkie-talkie squawked. "It's me," said Howie Carr's voice. "The firemen tried to back a hook and ladder truck up to the end of the elevator, and Calvin shot at them." "Anyone hurt?" Gil asked, holding onto the walkie-talkie with one hand and the ladder with the other. "I don't think so, but they're all lying around undercover," Howie said. "They're calling for the National Guard." "I guess that means we'd better hurry," Gil said. "Out." Johnny was already stepping through the opening onto the headhouse. Gil continued up the ladder to the ceiling. As he passed through the man-lift opening, Gil could see that Johnny was crouched by the headhouse door and had it opened about an inch. Calvin apparently hadn't noticed anything yet. The little twerp was probably distracted by the activities on the ground, Gil thought. Gil pushed up on the hatch with one hand and winced as he heard a faint squeal from the hinges that probably hadn't operated in months, if not years. The last thing he wanted to do was to drop the hatch with a crash onto the concrete. Fortunately, there was a small metal handle for him to grasp. He slowly pushed himself up through the opening and crawled out onto the headhouse roof, placing the hatch down as quietly as he could. His military training took over, and he crawled on his belly to the edge of the roof. Fortunately, Johnny hadn't made a move yet. Gil could see Calvin crouched behind a metal roof vent along the southern edge of the elevator, rifle in hand, looking at the activity on the ground. Gil saw a large number of police cars, fire truck, and two ambulances, all with lights flashing. Police and firefighters could be seen crouching behind the vehicles. There probably were some things Gil couldn't see from his angle. Gil knew that Calvin could see anyone coming out of the headhouse from his position, so some sort of distraction would be needed. He reached into his jean pocket and felt a wooden disc. Of course, he recalled. It was the piece of High John Conqueror root that Michelle Lofgren had given him on the beach in Florida. "Hold on to this," she had said. "It'll give you strength when you need it." Gil wasn't sure that strength was the issue here, but it would come in handy now. He pulled the piece of wood out of his pocket, quietly got up into a crouching position, and flung it out as hard as he could. The piece of root flew out past Calvin's position and angled down, landing on the drag conveyor with a resounding thud. Calvin jerked his head around and stood up suddenly, now facing away from the headhouse. Johnny saw his opportunity and came running full tilt from the doorway. Calvin turned back and managed to squeeze off a rifle shot without bothering to aim. Gil saw a flash of sparks from the corner of the headhouse. Ironically, Calvin's bullet had struck the video camera that he was so proud of having installed. Johnny leaped into a football-style tackle and struck Calvin at knee level. Calvin went over backward, and the rifle slid across the roof, striking a conveyor support. Gil started toward the ladder down the north side of the headhouse, looking back to see the superintendent having grabbed Calvin's head and pounding it onto the concrete. Northern Star, Part 41. Northern Star employee Calvin Fogerson has holed up on the roof of the grain elevator in Monrovia, armed with a rifle and with the man lift locked out and the man lift shaft's ladder electrified with an electric fence generator. Acting General Manager Gil Mayer and Acting Superintendent Johnny Littlefeather have found a way to disable the generator and have made their way to the top of the roof. Gil distracts Calvin, giving Johnny a chance to grab the murder suspect. "Stop," Gil shouted as he ran across the roof toward Johnny and Calvin. Johnny had a knee on the prostrate Calvin's back and could see Calvin bleeding from another head wound. "We need him alive." "This punk doesn't deserve to live," Johnny said. "That's for the court to decide," Gil replied. He reached down to pull Johnny away from Calvin. "He's not going anywhere. He's not going to harm anyone now." The two men pulled Calvin into a sitting position. Calvin appeared to be groggy. "You may have given him a concussion," Gil told Johnny. "He's going to need medical attention." Johnny scowled and said nothing. Gil walked over to the guard railing on the south side of the elevator. The police below immediately aimed their firearms at him. Gil frantically waved them off. "We have Calvin up here," Gil shouted down, hoping he was loud enough for people to hear. "He's hurt. I'm sending the man lift down." One officer spoke into a bullhorn. "How many people will the man lift hold?" "Two," Gil shouted back. "We need some officers and EMTs up here." Gil went over to the man lift entrance, unlocked the controls, and sent it down manually. Two emergency medical technicians were the first back up the man lift. They took one look at Calvin and had Johnny lay him back down on the rooftop surface. One called down to the ambulance on the radio for a stretcher. Gil knew that the local emergency responders had practiced lowering patients from the rooftop on a stretcher, so he had no concerns on that score. Save the taxpayers some money if they drop him, he thought. The passengers on the second man lift trip included another EMT with a stretcher and Detective Kellerman from the Monrovia Police Department. "Is Calvin conscious enough to understand his Miranda rights?" the detective asked Gil. Gil wasn't expecting an apology from the officer for suspecting him of murdering Sally Finkel. That would be little too much pride for most cops to swallow. "You'll have to judge for yourself," Gil said. Kellerman walked over to the group working on strapping Calvin to a stretcher. The officer appeared to be speaking with the EMTs, then with Calvin for a few minutes. Then he reached down and placed a pair of handcuffs on the wounded employee. Gil thought that was probably overkill, since Calvin wouldn't be moving anywhere, but figured he was probably standard police procedure. Kellerman came back over to Gil and Johnny. "Obviously, we'll want both of you down at the station later to make a statement," he said. He looked at Gil with what seemed to be a certain amount of reluctance. "Good work," he said. "Thanks," Gil said, and left it at that. It would take a while to patch up his relationship with the detective. Gil and Johnny helped the EMTs lower Calvin to the ground, where he was bundled into an ambulance. An officer climbed into the ambulance with Calvin. Gil figured that once Calvin was well enough to leave the hospital, he'd be going straight to jail. Calvin's father, who lived in a ramshackle trailer, certainly wouldn't have the money to post bail, and Calvin had no other friends who would care to. For a moment, Gil almost felt sorry for the kid. but not too sorry. Gil thought about Marcus Grover lying dead on the pavement below, a potentially brilliant football career erased in a few seconds. He and Johnny were the last to leave the rooftop. Outside, beyond the perimeter tape, Gil spotted Tom Hasselmeyer from the local weekly newspaper and another reporter type, possibly from the Mason City Daily. Several photographers were snapping photos. The out-of-town reporter was shouting questions at Gil, which the acting manager tried to ignore. He spotted Bob Alsop, who was signaling for Gil to come with him into the office. Gil and Bob found the co-op office empty. Not surprising, given everything was happening. Bob mentioned for Gil to sit down in the lounge area. "I just wanted to say that you've done an excellent job through all of this," Bob said. "You used me," Gil replied. "All along, you knew that Ole Torvaldsen was ripping off the cooperative, and probably that someone at the elevator had murdered Marcus Grover. And you had me put my career and maybe my freedom on the line to complete an investigation you couldn't or wouldn't do yourself." Bob looked taken aback. "I think I would say that God used you, Gil," he said. "You were doing God's work here. Anyway, you'll be the general manager here as soon as the board gets a chance to vote on it. So I wouldn't be complaining if I were you." "Before I accept that position," Gil said, "I want to make it clear that while I respect the board of directors and its responsibility for setting overall policy for this cooperative, I expect that I'll be able to conduct the day-to-day operations of this business without undue interference from you or anyone else on the board." "I think you've earned that right," Bob Balsop said. "Good. We understand each other," Gil replied. "In that case, I'll accept the position." "Fine," said the board chairman. "I don't think I'll have to tell you that you'll be facing some difficult times to start out." Bob Alsop spoke the truth about that. Northern Star's board set a general membership meeting for the following Tuesday night to explain the situation to the entire membership. The Monrovia High School gymnasium was packed to capacity, and most of the former members present were clearly unhappy. The board had decided, at Tom Hasselmeyer's suggestion, to open the meeting to the general public. So not only was the room filled with angry farmers, but the press had shown up in full force as well, including a couple of staffers from the Des Moines Register and television crews from around Iowa and southern Minnesota. One local affiliate had set up a satellite feed for CNN. Gil gave the same PowerPoint presentation he'd shown to the board of directors a week earlier. The noise of subdued comments in the audience grew slowly throughout the presentation. At the end of the presentation, Bob opened the meeting for questions. Farmers lined up behind three standing microphones that had been set up in front of the gymnasium bleachers. "I'd like to know what effect all of these shenanigans will have on my equity," a burly cattle feeder from Pottawatomie began. "What assurances do we have that no one is still speculating with co-op funds today?" asked another. "Can we expect to get paid for our crops this fall? Can the Grover family sue us for what happened to their boy?" "Eddie Lofgren had always been a good neighbor, and I resent the things being said about him." Bob and Gil answered some of the questions as best they could, and the cooperative's attorney was there to answer some others. Gil was somewhat taken aback by the number of members who questioned his fitness as a manager. Apparently, the rumors that he was a suspect in the murder of Sally Finkel. After one such diatribe, Gil glanced over at Bob Alsop, and the chairman just nodded his head. The meeting went past 11 p.m., a late night for people who habitually rise well before dawn. In the high school parking lot, Bob Alsop and Curly Peterson told Gil not to worry about any of the remarks about him. "The truth is, you're going to have to earn people's trust in this town, and that's going to take time," Bob commented. Michelle Lofgren and Charlie Toussaint arrived in Iowa, and Gil put them up at a motel near Mason City at his own expense. Michelle kept her word and spent a half a day making a statement to the police, though she insisted that Gil be present during the deposition. Detective Kellerman assured her that her statement would clear her father of murder, though Gil knew that the farmer would still be facing some serious fraud and embezzlement charges and probably would end up doing some prison time. The next day, Gil was surprised to receive a visit from Michelle and Charlie. Gil asked if they were thinking about staying around Monrovia. "No way," Michelle said. You've been a great host, but this will never be our home again. Actually, we're thinking about moving to Chicago. Charlie's artwork has been doing really well there. Well, you're always welcome to drop in any time you happen to be in the area, Gil told them. And I wanted to thank you for your help on this, Michelle. I had to think about it for a while, but I think that I did the right thing, she said. And I'm glad that you were able to get some good use out of the High John Conqueror route that I gave you. Gil felt stunned for a moment. How had she known about that? Gil hadn't even told the police about how he'd used that little piece of wood to distract Kelvin Fogerson on the roof of the elevator. Man, you look like you have the entire weight of that grain elevator on your shoulders, Charlie Toussaint commented. I do, Gil said, but I can handle it.
Thank you for listening to Northern Star, a grain elevator murder mystery, sponsored by M&M Specialty Services and PerkinElmer. To learn more about their full range of products and services, visit mmspecialtyservices.com and perkinelmer.com. This concludes Northern Star, a grain elevator murder mystery, written by Ed Stroyevsky, narrated by Stu Ellis, produced by John Reedy, webpage designed by Leslie Kasner, published by Mark Avery. This has been a production of Grain Journal Magazine, the voice of the grain and feed industry.